Modern-day philosophers find inspiration in some unusual places. When Mark Rowlands was a young professor, he adopted a wolf. It became his constant companion, even a teacher of sorts, and the subject of his book, The Philosopher and the Wolf. Now, Rowlands has come out with a sequel, Running with the Pack, which offers philosophical lessons gleaned from a lifetime of running. Steve Paulson recently caught up with him.
Mark, you write about the heartbeat of the run. What kind of experience is that?
Basically, it's an experience of being sort of lost in the run, so that you're no longer thinking anymore. I mean, I talk about it as a heartbeat because I've run most of my life, I suppose, with dogs or canines of various sorts, and you know, there's a certain kind of place you get in the run where, you know, you're surrounded by the panting of the dog's breath and the click of their claws on the tarmac and so on.
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, you make the argument that running is intrinsically valuable. I mean, not because it makes you feel better or makes you thinner or healthier, although it can do all of those things, but
yes,
there's something about running just in itself that is good.
It's a conclusion I arrived at, painfully slowly, really. I mean, when I was 27, I did something, well, a bit stupid, really. I acquired an animal called Brennan. He sold to me as a wolf. I think it's quite likely he was a wolf-dog mix, but whatever he was, he sort of grew up. And one day my thoughts were disturbed by the sound of a thud, thud, thud coming from the room at the back of the house. The thumps were made by the, you know, the sound of the armchair locked firmly in Brennan's jaws, being repeatedly slammed against the frame of the door. And I think it was, you know, precisely this moment that I decided that, you know, all things considered, it might be a good thing if Brennan were kept constantly exhausted, and thus began my life of running as an adult.
So basically, you were trying to wear him out.
Absolutely. And this sort of continued over the years. Our pack got bigger. There was Nina, sort of Malamute German Shepherd mix, who joined us, and then Tess, Brennan's daughter. I was running basically to keep this pack of three rapacious canines as mellow as I could keep them. Put in the sort of jargon of philosophers, I mean, philosophers would say, well, this means that running has what they call instrumental value. Its value is a means to an end. But I think over the years, over the 20 years or so, I discovered that less and less was I running for some specific purpose. And more I found myself running simply to run.
Well, I want to take you back to your personal history, especially with your wolf, Brennan. I mean, a profoundly important relationship to you. And you said you first got him when you were in your late 20s, right? A young philosophy professor.
Yeah.
Sounds kind of impractical, frankly, to get a wolf when you're a teacher.
Well, it quickly became clear, like within the space of a few hours, that Brennan could never be left on his own for more than about 2 minutes because he just started destroying things. And so, I mean, the upshot was that I had to take him with me wherever I went. You know, so I used to take him into lectures with me in. I'd give him a good run first, so most of the time he would sleep.
You know? Wait, but you'd be up at the podium in the lecture hall, and the wolf would be at your feet?
Usually over in a corner of the room at a kind of safe distance from me, yeah.
What did your students think of having a wolf in the room?
Well, there were never any sort of complaints anyway. I mean, after a while, you know, I became known as the wolf guy.
And would Brennan just sit there the whole time, or would he start to wander around?
Most of the time, sometimes things would go a little awry. I mean, you can imagine, for example, what forced me to put this little appendage on my syllabus. Note, please do not pay any attention to the wolf. He will not hurt you. However, if you do have any food in your bags, please ensure that those bags are securely fastened shut.
Meaning there was an occasion where it was not securely fastened shut.
Precisely, and the student's lunch disappeared before their eyes. I mean, sometimes, you know, he would just wake up and start howling, you know, and
in the middle of a lecture.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm sure the students probably wish they could do the same, actually. But
and then you talk about how you were an avid rugby player. You were part of a local team. You travel a lot, and Brennan would always go with you.
Yes, I mean, pretty much everything I did, you know, we lived our lives in, I suppose, each other's pockets. I mean, any socializing I did, you know, bars and parties, and I did a lot of that when I lived in Alabama. You know, he would have to come too. If I went out on a date, you know, he would play the lupine gooseberry. And so, So our lives were pretty much, you know, lived within each other's eyeshot, you know, for the whole of 11 years. When Brennan was around four, we moved from the US to Ireland and then on to Wales, England, and finally to France.
That must have been hard to take a wolf into another country.
Well, the first part of the trip to Ireland was hard because this was in the days of quarantine, before they had pet passports and things like that. And so Brennan had to go into quarantine, essentially, you know, jail for dogs for 6 months.
Wow, that's a long time.
It is a long time, yeah, it is a long time. After that, there was no problem. I was able to move him from one country to the other with no difficulties at all.
Now, in your previous book, The Philosopher and the Wolf, you say at one point, much of what you learned about how to live, about life and its meaning, you learned from Brennan. And what it is to be human, you learned from a wolf.
Yeah.
It's an extraordinary thing to say.
Yes, because of the kind of relationship we had, where we were basically within touching distance of each other for this large period of life.
You must have thought about what it means to be a human, as opposed to what it might mean to be a wolf. And my sense is that in your ledger, the wolf actually might come out a little bit on top of the human. Yeah.
So this did start a kind of period of reflection on, you know, the idea of human superiority. The Philosopher and the Wolf was kind of basically an examination of probably the three main ways we distinguish ourselves and think of ourselves as better than other animals. One way is, you know, we're better than them because we're smarter, we're more intelligent than they are. Another suggestion that philosophers have had is that we're better than animals because we have morality and they don't. We're moral beings and they're not. And the third is that we're different and we're superior because we understand that we're going to die. And I wanted to examine the whether these stories really, whether they held water. And so, for example, I examined the idea of intelligence, and I argued, you know, drawing on the work of primatologists like Andrew White and Dick Byrne and so on, the so-called Machiavellian intelligence hypothesis, that intelligence within us has you know, fairly dark roots, if you like. It's evolved to a considerable extent to allow us to deceive and manipulate our fellow apes.
Because that's how we exist in a highly social community. I mean, we have to kind of read other people and to some degree and manipulate them so we can get what we want.
Yeah, that's the idea.
Well, and that leads directly to then the other thing that you were talking about, morality. And I can't imagine a wolf doing evil, whereas humans clearly have the capacity to commit atrocities.
Yes, I think to an extent that's right. I mean, there's a certain kind of malice aforethought, if you like, that you find in apes that you don't find in other creatures. I mean, the sort of the violence that occurs between wolves of the same pack, at least, it's mostly sort of spontaneously, non-premeditated, just eruption of violence is over quickly, and most of the time no great harm is done. I'm sort of struck reading a passage from Franz de Waal's book, Chimpanzee Politics, where he talks about a disagreement between two chimpanzees. One is heading over to beat the other, basically, because that's the way chimps like to sort out their grievances. But he stops on the way to pick up a rock so he can beat the other ape more viciously. And so it's that kind of premeditation, I think, that makes what humans do and other apes a different kind of wrong, a different kind of evil than the sort of thing that animals do.
Well, and then let's get to the third thing that you mentioned, which is that humans have knowledge of mortality, that they're going to die. And I'm guessing that wolves probably don't have that. They probably have no sense that they are going to die.
Yes. In order to understand death, you really have to understand the concept of nevermore, that death is final, irrevocable, and nevermore will you be around. And I'm not convinced that any other creature than a human understands the idea of nevermore.
And it's fascinating to think about how our lives would change if we had no awareness that we're going to die. I mean, I can't even imagine what that would be like.
No, I don't think any of us can, really. I mean, there was a kind of episode, I suppose, which bears on this. Brennan and I, we were living in France. Brennan had cancer, and he was going to die. And he sort of became apparently healthy again. You know, on one day he sort of did his usual party piece, which was basically an invitation for me to take him for a run, We hadn't run together for over a year because of his illness, and we went out for a run, our last run together. And there's something about that. I mean, if I had cancer, cancer and other mortal diseases, because we understand we're going to die, they're afflictions of time. For animals, it's not the same. I mean, it's about how they feel in a particular moment. At this particular time, I feel fine. Therefore, I'm going for a run.
You have kind of a heartbreaking scene about Brennan's death.
Right.
You were in France at the time, and you took him out to a place where you had often walked to bury him.
Yes. Yeah.
And then you had a kind of vigil over a fire at night, and you seemed to almost have a vision of seeing him in a pile of stones you had constructed. Can you tell me about that?
Brennan was put down that day by the vet. Yeah, I buried him near where we were living. Basically decided to stay there for the night. It was January in the south of France. It was pretty cold, so I sort of built a fire. I'd built a sort of a funeral sort of cairn, a stone cairn, to go over his body. As it turned out, the stone cairn was it looked very much like Brennan, the way he used to lie down, nose touching his tail and so on. No doubt at the time I might have thought, well, it's got to be the Jack Daniels I just consumed, but in fact, it looked the same the next day and the same after that, which is very, very strange. I mean, I have various sort of explanations of it, but it is a very strange, very eerie experience. Yeah, I referred to it as this ghost of stone, and it did look like him.
Mark Rowlands is a philosopher at the University of Miami. He's the author of The Philosopher and the Wolf and Running with the Pack. He spoke with Steve Paulson.